Larry's been staying with us the last couple days. He came up for the coaches' conference and the NCAA women's volleyball finals, the Final Four. He got tickets where I could attend with him on Thursday evening when they had the playoffs there, the quarterfinals, and I guess it was the semifinals would be what it would be. And you know, watching those girls out there diving down, catching those volleyballs on the floor and putting them back up perfectly back to the setter, and watching those spikes slam down to the ground reminded me of the way I used to play. But we used to have some fun. I never really played volleyball for Larry. I rode bikes for him mostly and didn't get into volleyball till later, but we sure had some very, very good times. You know, Larry's known for being an encouraging person. If you've been on his teams, or if you were in school or around the activities or the clinics or up at camp, Perry might disagree with that at camp, but he's known for being very, very positive. He was faculty at Ambassador College in Big Sandy when it closed in 1977. He was faculty in Pasadena at Ambassador College when it closed in 78. He was faculty again in Big Sandy when he was terminated in 96, and he's still smiling. So something must be working. He always seems to land on his feet, although sometimes he does that in a rather unusual way. I'll square the deck here for comments. We had a bike trip back in 76 where we went coast to coast, and it was 4,300 miles, and we rode 6 days a week, and we averaged, I forget now, 70, 80 miles a day, and we just ride and ride. And one day we rode, I think, 110 miles was the longest day through Wyoming, and we really had a spectacular time. But he has a way to keep his composure and his cool, and you don't always see what goes on behind the scenes. But we were over on the eastern side of the trip, and we'd been riding all day, and we come barging through with about 90-some people on bikes to this little town, and we pull up to a park where we're going to have our lunch, and a policeman pulls up behind us, and he was really upset. We'd disturbed all the traffic in the city and tied it up and put it into snarls, and he came racing up behind us in his patrol car, and Coach looked over and saw him come up, and he says, "Well, Mark, why don't you go see what he wants?" And so I stroll over, because I was supposed to be his assistant there. I was the rover and the mechanic, and that was my job at college, was to work for the bike team and for Coach. And so he sent me over there, and I walked up. Policeman got out of his car and asked him what we could do for him, and he just chewed me up and down one side and down the other. He steam was coming out of his ears. You know, he was yelling at me and getting it all out of his system. And Coach kind of watches until he kind of spends himself. And then Coach strolled on over and slapped him on the back, said hi, offered him lunch, and they walked away telling jokes and having a good time. And so sometimes what it takes to keep your composure is just to have somebody else around and take the heat. But we had some grand times. And there have been a lot of people over the years in the church, at least in my life, who in various capacities wanted to train me and prepare me for service in the church. And some of them openly told me that they were training me, they were teaching me, they were working with me. The fact is, most of the men who felt that way or told me that were not men that I looked to anyway. It was, in some respect, they wanted to make me something like they were, and I didn't want to be like that. I guess one of the men I did want to be like was Larry, because he never told me he was training me, but he was. He had an attitude and approach and a relationship that he maintained that truly was an example to me, and so if I could give him public credit for part of that, I surely would do so. It's been a great association over the years. Our attitude, the way we function, the way we relate to each other, really does affect how we operate, how successful we are in many respects in this life. I think I've mentioned at other times that Mrs. Luker on Friday nights will send out a message to the ladies, and we've joked at times, the men, that maybe we should just put them in charge and everything would work real smoothly and be fixed right away. But Mrs. Luker sent out a message last night, and I pull it off and read it first, and then I take it up to Michelle. And it was interesting because of the sermon I was working on, and it's always fascinating to me when I begin to focus on something to prepare to try to bring the services here, how other circumstances will begin to accentuate that and support in that way what I'm doing. It says, "Hello, everyone." I'll just read to you some parts of it. "Another week has so quickly slipped by, I'm certain that for many of you it was a challenging one. Over and over, I'm hearing similar things from many of you, the sense that Satan is trying to wear us out. It seems that we are all having trials in our personal lives as well as within the congregations and even the church as a whole. There are times it does seem a bit daunting, doesn't it?" She said the following poem was written in the 1800s as a reminder that through the ages people have been tried. In other words, don't think it's something strange that happens to you. This is what people face in this life. And then she included a poem, and she said in the poem, "Be strong. We're not here to play, to dream, to drift. We have hard work to do and loads to lift. Shun not the struggle, face it, 'tis God's gift. Be strong. Say not the days are evil, who's to blame, and fold the hands and acquiesce. Oh, shame. Stand up, speak out, and bravely, in God's name, be strong. It matters not how deep entrenched the wrong, how hard the battle goes, the day how long. Faint not, fight on. Tomorrow comes the song." Just a comment. Just an attempt by Mrs. Luker to add encouragement and strength where she can. And so I was reading that, and I took it up to Michelle and again began to refocus on the sermon I was preparing to present. A number of you have spoken to me recently about the circumstances that you are currently facing as well, sometimes in tears, sometimes in just heartfelt concern, and struggling through various circumstances about the battles that you fight with discouragement. Battles that are very real. They're battles that I fight too. They're battles that Michelle fights too. And we can't just write them off and pretend that they don't exist, but we can't afford to succumb to them either. Glenn White mentioned recently a particular problem in a very graphic way in this line. But he described the problem. He says, "You know, it's like holding on to a mad dog by the ears. Everybody knows you have to let go, but you know, letting go is indeed a traumatic thing. It's not that we don't know sometimes what we need to do, or even that what we're faced with, but it's like holding that dog, and you know the minute you let go, he's going to bite you, but if you hold on to him, he'll bite you too." And so it's a hard decision as to how to make that transition to where you back away and get out of there in the best possible way that you can. Now, God knows our plight. Christ lived his life in this flesh. He understood what we go through and what we face. Isaiah 53 describes Christ prophetically, and it says that he was stricken and he was smitten and that he was afflicted and that he was despised and rejected. Now, whatever we could possibly be facing is something, therefore, Christ intimately understands because he lived it, he felt it, he experienced it as well. But God shows us that because he understands, and because he is God and not flesh and weak as we are, that he is there for us and intercedes for us and is on our side, standing with us. 2 Corinthians 1, starting in verse number 3, I want to read you a few scriptures here in relationship to what God's perspective is and what he does for us. Say, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort." God the Father, says, is the God of all comfort. What other word in the Bible, if we're looking at, now I'm reading from the New King James, but because the translation in the King James is more parallel to this, what other place in the Bible is God referred to in the sense of being comfort? You remember when Christ said in John to the disciples that he had to go away? And he said, "When I go, I'm going to leave you. I'm going to send something to you, another comforter," as it is mentioned in the King James. Now, the New King James translates it as helper. But Christ was saying, "I am a comforter, and I know you won't see me anymore, and you're going to think you're going to be missing, but I'll send you another comforter." Effectively, the presence, my Father's presence, we will be with you. And so God says he is the God here of all comfort. And he comforts us in our tribulation that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. The point being is that as God comforts us, that we ought to be able to in some way comfort others as well. That it's a process. It flows through us. We're not reservoirs for the Holy Spirit. We don't store it up. We're channels. It flows through us. It flows in from one and out from the other as such. If we ever think or imagine somehow that we just store it up and then we live off of it like you do a reserve, then we miss the point altogether. If that Holy Spirit is not flowing into us on an ongoing basis, then there is no reserve to flow out. That's important to maintain. For as the sufferings of Christ abound in us, so our consolation also abounds through Christ. And in verse number 7, and our hope for you is steadfast because we know that as you are partakers of the sufferings, so also you will partake of the consolation. He's just saying, look, you suffer, I understand, God is there with you, and in so doing, you will be able to be there with others as well. The word comfort here in the Greek means technically and literally a calling to one side. So when God says that he is the God of comfort, it means he'll be there at our side. He's the God of the one you can call to be with you. And so that's what the word technically means. Now, positive feelings, therefore, and purpose should flow into us from God, and then they should flow back out from us to others. Now, you know and I know that is a struggle, but there is no easier way. There is no easier way than that. It may be hard to do what is right, but it is not any easier to do what is wrong. It is not simpler to avoid that process and to just go ahead and let the anger and the bitterness fester and infest us, or the frustration just spew it out. That doesn't make life better. There's always payback. And by payback, I'm not even referring to punishment from God. I'm referring to our lives and our families and our friends and the circumstances that we face on an intimate scale. Larry and I were talking last night, and he mentioned, you know, we have to focus, he said, on positive energy rather than negative energy. Negative energy is, oh, you know, the weather's lousy, and I haven't had a very good life, and my car is a piece of junk, and I really don't like what I'm doing. That's negative energy. And he was just remarking that we need to focus on the positive energy, on the things that we can do, and our hopes and our dreams, and the encouragement. And one of the faculty members one time asked Larry, how do you do what you do? How come your classes and your teams are so responsive to you? And asked him, and he, you know, I wasn't there to know exactly word for word how he stated that and what he said, but it's obvious to me that it's something that he is simply openly and willing to share himself, and he does it in a positive way. He encourages. He takes the assistant, lets him get chewed up by the police, and then he can still maintain a good attitude and approach. Christ is a comforter to us. He is someone who gets called to our side. He eases our minds. He lifts our burdens. And we should be striving to be comforters for others as well. Now, the reality is, though, that the society we live in, this world we live in, is not necessarily very comforting in God's place, is it? Biting sarcasm, the way things are sometimes expressed, competition is competition that becomes very ruthless at times, vanity and strife. But then God says that we're not to come to be a part of this world. In that sense, we're to come out of the world. So we need to be different than that. We need to be people who are responsive to each other, positive, full of hope. People who encourage each other, who brighten other people's lives. And I do believe, brethren, as we strive to do that, that we're going to find that our lives are a little brighter as well. I won't go through it today. I'll go through it another time. But go read Psalm 77 sometime. It talks about depression. It talks about deep depression. It talks about a depression that closes in on you and begins to smother you. And then it shows how, with a little ray of light and an effort to reach out and to begin to focus outside, how that begins to turn. It's one step in a process. But it's one of those things that is good to have as a tool to use in our emotional circumstances that we face. Life has in it hills and valleys. There are good times and there are bad. We need to make the best we can of the bad, but we need to truly rejoice in the good when we do have it. And I think we have more than we sometimes always focus on. I assume Margaret Lay is listening today by phone. Frank says she is. She can't be embarrassed because she can't be here, so she's in her room by herself. But Margaret Lay is a source of encouragement to me. I sit with Margaret in her room by herself in a rest home, in a convalescent center, assisted living. And I can look out the window and see things that she can't see, which is most of the things outside of that window. And then when I talk to her and I tell her what the teens are doing or what the church is doing or what I'm doing or what my family is doing or where we went or what our plans are, those are things she can't do. And so I sit there and I look at things she can't see and talk to her about things she cannot do. And yet she is still very positive and she lifts me up in the process. I can do what she cannot, but she is the one that encourages me the most. It's very, very helpful, and I appreciate that. Some people do have that as a gift. Some people don't have that as a gift, but it's a gift that we must be in pursuit of. We need to pursue spiritual gifts. I had a discussion with someone this past week on spiritual gifts as well. How it's something that we ought to be in pursuit of, desirous of, that God tends to give us those things that we desire. We commit our resources to the things that are most important to us, and we generally will obtain them. If we really want it, we will make it a priority and set other issues aside. And I believe in some respects spiritual gifts are the same. If there are gifts that we absolutely desire, and if they're for the right reason, and if they're gifts indeed that God can allow us to have for His service, then I believe that He will grant them to us. This may sound strange because we've presented it in different ways over the years, but I've heard people say, you know, they never wanted to be an elder. I don't think you ought to ever ordain anybody an elder who doesn't want to be an elder. To me, that would seem like a mistake. I did want to be an elder. Now, I didn't pursue it politically. I didn't go and line up people who I thought would put me in that position. I simply trained, and I served, and I married someone who would serve, and Michelle served. And yet, it wasn't something I went and lined myself up for, but it's something that I desired. And I had a chance. I served as a deacon as well. And the church is everything, in that sense, almost that I have. It's my life. But I used to go to spokesman's clubs so I could learn to speak, so I could learn to communicate, so I could learn to teach. And I wanted to teach. You know, I don't think you ought to have somebody teaching you that doesn't want to teach. I don't think people should be parents that don't want to be parents. I don't think people should get married that don't want to get married. I mean, let's just play it across the line. The people who really want to do something are willing to, in a right way, do it right, then those are people that maybe can have those opportunities the best, or maybe will utilize them. Now, I realize you can want something for the wrong reasons and in the wrong way and misuse it as well. But 1 Corinthians 12 talks about spiritual gifts. Verse number 4, there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. There's differences of ministries, but the same Lord. There's diversities of activities, but the same God who works all in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all. And then it begins to mention different gifts that are given and for different reasons. For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healings by the same Spirit. Now, I do believe that indeed does refer to healing physical infirmities. I don't have the gift where I can call you up out of the audience, whatever your infirmity might be, and decide that you will be healed. I just don't have such a gift as that. I have the gift of being able to go before God as He has chosen to use His ministry for and petition God on your behalf. And God has honored that in many cases. And individuals have been healed in God's church by their faith, by my faith, by our faith, however God has chosen to intervene. But when it says here about gifts of healing, the word can also be used in a spiritual sense. It can refer to a healing of the heart, a healing of the mind, a healing of the emotions. Can you have gifts of healings? I absolutely believe you can if you desire them. You can have a gift from God where you intercede on someone's behalf and help them to come and heal. I think there's still a lot of healing yet to take place in God's church. There's still a lot of pain among the people of God. I think we all need to contribute to that in any way that we can, that healing process will fully take place. Dr. Torrance, when I was in college, was the registrar. Many of you know him or have met him or knew of him at least. When I was a student, he was there, and I knew him over the years, and I really respected and loved him. He was in Bataan, and was in the Bataan Death March in the Philippines in World War II. Now, if you don't know what that was, there's no way I can totally describe that to you. As the Japanese forces overran the Philippines, our soldiers who were there were captured and very brutally and unbelievably, horribly treated by their captors. And the death march was called a death march because that's exactly what it was. You started out marching. If you fell back, they shot or bayoneted you. If you fell down, they shot or bayoneted you, just pushed you aside. If you were sick, they shot or bayoneted you. And those who survived the march were alive, and those who had any problem whatsoever of any kind were dead, and that's just simply the way they drew the line. And then they put you on a ship to Japan, locked you up inside, and never fed you or watered you or cared for you or did anything, just locked you up in the hold and sailed for Japan. And those that lived, lived, and those that died, died. It was just as simple as that. And then they put him in a prisoner camp there in Japan, and basically many of those died again as well through various means and reasons. And Dr. Torrance went through that and he survived. He lost about everything. He lost his health. He went without food and he went without shelter and he went without clothing and he went without medical care assistance and he went without his friends, because most of his friends, the vast majority, died. I think something like maybe 90% or something. Coach and I were trying to remember the figures last night, but the vast majority of those people died, didn't make it. Very few actually made it through that whole process. Dr. Torrance made it out of there, and he told stories to some of us that I can't even stop honestly and tell you because of the detail and because of what then took place. He lost everything, and he lived like an animal except worse. After the war, when he returned home, he determined as much as possible to never complain again. Because no matter how bad it got, it couldn't possibly be any worse than where he had already been. And no matter what he had to go without, or no matter what complication he endured, it wouldn't be as bad as it had already been. And so he just determined, as much as it was possible for him in his mind, to never complain again. And so I watched Dr. Torrance over the years. He lost two wives to cancer, wives that he loved, wives that were close and dear to him, marriages that were solid and strong. Time and time again, at various circumstances and for reasons, he was near his own deathbed because of sickness or illness or disease. And you know what? I never saw him. I've seen him depressed. I've seen him almost crawl around at times of great burden and weight, but it was a cycle, and he would go down under times of duress, and he would come back up, and he would go on. But you know, amazingly so, I personally never heard him complain. He was able to encourage and joke. He teased about redheads, and he would find any redhead he could, and automatic acceptance into the college. He just joked and had a lighthearted perspective of life, and he was pleasant. Proverbs 17, verse 22. Dr. Torrance wasn't pleasant because life was easy, life was hard. You and I have never tasted life as he tasted it. And how many of us have lost two of our mates to cancer or death as well on top of that, plus had our own health break, and still be faithful in our service to God? I mean, he went through something that I hope to never in this life ever face. But he did so in a way that he simply decided that he would take life at its best, and if it be possible in his mind, he would never complain again. That's an incredible thing to say. It's unbelievable. But I do believe it's really in a great scale of what God would have us to strive to do. Proverbs 17 and verse 22, a merry heart does good like medicine. It's a balm, it's an assist, it's a cure, it's a help, it's a comfort, it's a comforter at your side. But a broken spirit dries the bones. Proverbs 12, verse 25. Anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. You think there's an impact between our words and our thoughts and our own physical and spiritual strength? Obviously, I really believe that there is. In fact, I absolutely believe that there is. Even our health is affected by, to some degree, by whether we are positive or not. I had an article in my files that came out of Newsweek magazine now probably maybe 9 years ago. It goes back a ways because they have, over the last 1 to 2 decades, they've begun to do some major research into emotions and the chemical responses of the body. And 10 years ago, they had just cracked the door on what that process was, but now they've kicked it open and they can see specifically and they can walk through and tell you the chemical processes that take place. This article was written just as that door was beginning to open. And it's referring to the decade before. It says, the past 10 years have witnessed an explosion of research findings suggesting that the mind and body act on each other in often remarkable ways. With the help of sophisticated new laboratory tools, investigators are demonstrating that emotional states can translate into altered responses in the immune system. The complex array of organs, glands, and cells that comprises the body's principal mechanism for repelling invader is damaged and injured or strengthened and secured by the thoughts in our own minds and the feelings in our hearts. One study headed by psychologist Sandra Levy of the Pittsburgh Cancer Institute this year found that a factor called joy, which means mental resilience and vigor, it means you have hope, you have belief, you have expectation that is positive, that a factor called joy was the second strongest predictor of survival time for a group of patients with recurrent breast cancer. You know what the first strongest indicator of survival time was for recurrent breast cancer patients? Not having a recurrence. That's kind of simple, isn't it? Well, if you haven't had a recurrence in 15 years, that's the strongest indication that you're doing well. After not actually having a reoccurrence, the next biggest factor was what they called joy. It was attitude and approach. It was the next strongest indicator of how long it would be before something recurred. The immune responses researchers have observed are striking. It is almost as if the body were turned inside out and the cells themselves experienced grief or fear or hope. Now, there's been a lot of research take place since this article, and because I didn't sit here and put this together at the library, I didn't have an article that was available from last year. But that's very much indeed what has taken place. Encouraging a person who is sick is like giving them medicine to assist in their recovery. It's like helping them to get well. So why wouldn't we use encouragement then to help people stay well, to keep them from collapsing in that sense in the first place? Or better yet, why not use it to help maintain our own health and our own strength? It's not a cure-all. It won't overcome everything, but it has an impact. It's an impact that we have control of. A book I read years ago, and at that time kind of went out through refresher and then went out into the field, and ministers gave certain sermons on aspects of it, was The Anatomy of an Illness by Norman Cousins. How many of you have remembered the book, or was it mentioned here? Well, only a couple. That's too bad. I went through here for time's sake, and I deleted most of my references to what I was going to say because I felt like, well, this is a book that came a long time ago, but let me at least verbally run through some of what was addressed here by the author. Norman Cousins, this book was, oh, I don't know, I don't have the date on this, but let's say the book's probably at least 10, 15 years old now. It goes back a ways. Norman Cousins is senior lecturer at that time at the School of Medicine, University of California, Los Angeles. He's consulting editor of Men in Medicine, published at the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Columbia University. For almost all of his professional life, Norman Cousins has been affiliated with Saturday Review. He became its editor in 1940, a position he held for more than 30 years. He's presently editorial chairman. So this isn't somebody who just had a bad dream and decided to write about it. It's somebody who's had some significant experience in the medical field and in a professional field, and had something happen to him that was very serious and decided to write about it. Came down with some kind of disease. The doctors weren't able to really help him. Some of them told him, most of them told him, that they didn't think he would ever get well. He described his illness as his body was becoming unstuck. It was a disease of the collagen of the body, and his body began to just become sore and immobile, and the muscles weren't working, and the tissues began to break down, and it just worsened and worsened. And finally, doctors he was working with gave him a 1 in 500 chance of ever fully recovering. It just, the circumstances were incredibly bleak. He felt like the options they had given him weren't necessarily going to solve the problem under those circumstances, and so he began to search for a way that he could address the issues himself in something that hadn't been tried, at least in his case. Part of the program that he decided was that he needed to strengthen his mental outlook. He needed to be encouraged, and he needed to have hope, and he needed to believe that things would be better than they were, instead of the depression and the frustration that would surround you when your function shut down. He went out and got himself a bunch of funny movies, old Laurel and Hardy and Three Stooges movies, and he began to play them as he lay there in bed and try to bring up his laughter and strengthen him and encourage him in that way. And they were taking tests of the infection and the rate of decline, and he noticed that after periods of laughter, not only was his pain diminished and in some cases even momentarily disappeared, but the test results improved as well. And so he began to laugh and joke and watch movies to try to increase his attitude and approach, and he began to work on his attitude, and he worked on some nutritional things as well, but he focused in the book as much as that on attitude and approach. And he got well. It was an incredible, remarkable thing, so he says, well, I'll make a million, I'll write a book. I want to read just toward the end of the book, a page that I pulled out. He says, I must not make it appear that all my infirmities disappeared overnight. He says, for many months I couldn't get my arms up far enough to reach for a book on a high shelf. My fingers weren't agile enough to do what I wanted them to do on the organ keyboard. He got to the point to where he could only move his neck one quarter of a turn, and he couldn't hardly move at all, and little nodules began to lump up and break out on his skin, and he was in very, very bad shape. He says, my neck had a limited turning radius. My knees were somewhat wobbly, and off and on I had to wear a metal brace. Even so, I was sufficiently recovered to go back to my job at the Saturday Review full-time again, and this was miracle enough for me. He says, is the recovery a total one? He said, year by year, the mobility has improved. I have become pain-free, except for one shoulder and my knees, although I have been able to discard the metal braces. I no longer feel a sharp twinge in my wrist when I hit a tennis ball or a golf ball, as I did for such a long time. I can ride a horse flat out, hold a camera with a steady hand, and I have recaptured my ambition to play the toccata and fugue. Is that right? Fugue? You can tell I'm a musician at heart. And D minor, though I find the going slower and tougher than I had hoped. My neck has a full turning radius again, despite the statement of specialists as recently as 1971 that the condition was degenerative and that I would have to adjust to a quarter turn. What conclusions do I draw from this entire experience? The first is that the will to live is not a theoretical abstraction, but a physiological reality with therapeutic characteristic. The second is that I was incredibly fortunate to have as my doctor a man who knew that his biggest job was to encourage to the fullest the patient's will to live and to mobilize all the natural resources of the body and mind to combat the disease. Basically, he just said his greatest benefit was the encouragement and support he had to be willing to try to strive to maintain a positive attitude and approach. And he believes, and he documents, again, it's a whole book that he wrote of this process that took place, on the effect that that had. Now, Michelle was at a doctor this past week, and once before that, because of some circumstances in her health, and interesting comment that he made, because you know, one of the things that he prescribed for her to do as support and as she strives to address the circumstances in her life to get well and to heal and be stronger again. And he prescribed for her to laugh more. And he said, you know, every day, once at least once a day, but more often, he said, I want you to sit down and I want you to just laugh. You just force yourself to begin to laugh. And he says it will strengthen you and it will help you. So now we sit at the table, maybe once a day, maybe in the morning, maybe at night, and we all, Grandpa and Grandma and Megan and Derek and Michelle and I, and we all look at each other and begin to laugh. Start to joke, and Megan and Derek get out their joke books and they tell us jokes like, you know, why did the gum cross the road? Well, it was stuck to the chicken. You know, why did the, some other animal, what other animal crossed the road? Some other, why did the dog cross the road? Well, the chicken had a day off, you know what I mean? So we're sitting there and we're trying to make each other laugh. And the doctor said, look, you need to do that. It'll help you get well. I think it's good advice. How does that apply to what we do here in the church? How does that apply to our service to God? You know, we have a magazine called what? The Good News. What does that mean? It means that that's the gospel. That's what the word gospel means, good news. And that's where the magazine's name came from. Is the gospel of the kingdom of God basically a warning of the judgment to come? Or is it an announcement of salvation, of opportunity? Is judgment there? Yes, judgment is there. It's part of the equation. But the purpose of the gospel is to announce salvation to mankind. It's good news. That's what we do, brethren. What we do is a positive thing. And it needs to be portrayed in a positive way by our lives, by our thoughts, by our words, by our relationships. By someone who walks in the door and sits in our midst, they ought to say, well, this is a good thing. If this is good news, then indeed we ought to evidence that by the way we relate, by the way we represent. As I said, unfortunately, our society, by and large, isn't going to assist us in that process. This is Satan's world. Long ago, I used to take Newsweek magazine, and one of the columns that they had in the magazine back then was called Buzzwords. And every couple of months, they'd come out with buzzwords. And what it was it would list all different professions, and then it would give you the name of what those people in those professions called the people they served behind their back. And it was incredible how derogatory it was. Each profession has its own words, and the umpires in baseball would call the players rats. They were rats. And pool cleaners had words for the swimmers who got the pool dirty. They call them dirt bags. Of course, that was just professional language. It was behind the scenes. And, of course, we have this, the way we relate racially and the way we relate nationally and the way we relate from country to city and city to country in terms of perspective. But customs officers, if a tourist came through with cheap souvenirs, they call them pack rats. And we could say, well, that's kind of a cute little term, you know, but it's not a reinforcing term. It's not an encouraging term. They had a term, the beach patrol, the police on the beaches, for those who weren't local that would come and use their beaches, they called them wash ashores. Like they washed in out of the surf, you know. They were the refuse that came to their beach for the day. When we were in Alaska for the feast one year, they have a term there for the newcomers, and it's called the chichacos. And it means greenhorn. It means newcomer. It's not exactly a badge of honor. It implies incompetence. Now, you might indeed have incompetence if you go to that climate and that culture and be in an environment which is so different. Yes, you might indeed be green. But to reinforce that, again, is not necessarily a badge of honor. How many of us grew up hearing terms like, you stupid idiot. You can't do that. Give it to me. Are you serious? Are you crazy? You ever said that? I've said that. I'm ashamed to say I've said that. But I've said that. You must think I'm nuts. Yeah, as a matter of fact. Sometimes Michelle will refer to a comment of mine to her, and she says, well, that's negative. I usually protest because I've trained myself to always defend myself. I said, it wasn't negative. I said, it was neutral. She said, well, it wasn't positive. Now, that's harder to respond to, you know. What do you mean? It wasn't positive? Well, you know, yeah, it wasn't positive, but that's harder to respond to. It's harder to defend against. You know, we can accomplish so much with kind and positive expressions and responses. We can accomplish so much. I don't care how limited we are, we have some area we can contribute to in a right and positive way. They have a magazine that used to be published at least called Cheer Magazine. It's Cheer People Up. And I had a health magazine I picked up someplace, hospital or otherwise, and they'd quoted from this Cheer Magazine. They had a comment here on an individual, a woman who used to write letters to people in the hospitals. Of course, the hospital had this in their literature to reinforce what they were kind of wanting others to do for them. And I'll read you a little account of someone who was involved with that. It says, while working as a nurse, I took care of an 8-year-old paraplegic boy. One day he asked me to read him a letter from his Aunt Betty. The letter ran more like a diary. Dear Billy, today you and I will take the bugs off the potato vines. Get a stick and a can, hold the can under the bug, and knock it off with a stick. We could use poison, but if the cows get through the fence, they might get poisoned. When the can's full, I'll show you what to do. I know what you do. You take them and flick them against the fence. Like Derek and I did all summer. They just splatter out there real good. Says the letter went on with another chore for Billy. Talked about a collie named Rags, gave all the details of a picnic at the creek, and ended with a beautiful story about an elf who painted butterfly wings. I never knew that. Billy had never seen his Aunt Betty, but he lived for those letters, and through them he led the life of a healthy, active farm boy, jumping fences, tearing his pants, climbing apple trees, running through the fields with Rags at his heels. One day I was near the town where Aunt Betty mailed her letters, so I stopped and asked the postman if he knew her. He says, Betty White mails letters every day to children in hospitals. Here she comes now. And I looked in the direction he pointed and saw a lady in a wheelchair making her way slowly towards us. Miss White's been crippled since she was 12, said the postmaster. All she does is sit and write. He says, I can't imagine what it is that she would have to write about. And it was touching to me to read that, that here's someone who had so little, and yet she was still trying to contribute in a way that was meaningful. We all need to do that in our own way and in the best way that we possibly can. I think over the last couple of years, because of stresses and pain and frustration, you know, there's a tendency to try to vent that off. And yet, when we do that to each other, it tends to infect each other in a way that is maybe a risk. Maybe those things, and I think they have to a degree, but I think even beyond that, in our personal circumstance, we need to really stop and give a hard focus. Are we encouraging each other? Are we lifting each other up? Are we carrying each other's burdens? You will not always feel good. We will not always have a good day. We will have crises. We will meet disaster. And there'll be times when we emotionally spike down. But we won't all spike down at once. Call Margaret Lay. Go visit her if you're spiking down, and she'll nudge you back up a little bit, I do believe. And so will some others among us. We need to do that for each other. It's critically important. Hebrews 10 talks about us actively supporting and encouraging each other. You know, I didn't give this sermon because I felt that I had finally mastered encouragement. I gave this sermon because I found myself struggling with the process as well. And I found myself evaluating my own emotional spikes and my own emotional needs. And, you know, many times as I teach and I have to go and I have to begin to consciously address some of these things. And it's an awakening at times. It's painful at times, because if you're going to do this process honestly and it's not going to be a fraud or a hypocrisy, then you're going to have to at least start to focus on these things in your life. I wish that every one of you could get up here and teach. And I wish that every one of you could get up here with whatever it is in your life that you struggle with and begin to teach us about that as well, because it forces us sometimes to change our focus. Hebrews 10, verse number 19. Paul here addressing, therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way which he consecrated for us through the veil, that is, his flesh, It's talking about building relationship to God and getting in there close to God. God at our side, but also us at His side. And having a high priest over the house of God, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. He's talking about the cleansing, the process of growth, of becoming closer in God's intentions. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for He who has promised is faithful, and let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works. To stir that process up. We eat salad dressing with our salad, and they're usually a mixture of the ones we're using of some oil and some vinegar or some spices. And it separates in the bottle, and in order to use it, you have to shake it up and agitate it and mix it. It says here that we should stir each other up in a positive way, in a right and proper way, to love and to good works. One of the reasons we assemble is to encourage each other, to strengthen each other. Remember the first time you walked into the feast and there was a few thousand people out there and you had never seen that before and you couldn't believe that many people were worshiping God in one place? It was encouraging. It was unifying. It was strengthening. We need to stir each other up. We need to swallow hard sometimes and really focus on just that which is right and good. This past week, Otto Peterson and I went visiting down in Kennewick. First chance I've had in that sense for more of an extended period of time around Otto and get to know him a little better. He used to work in Pasadena. You know, a number of us over the years, Joe down there in Kennewick and Rod there, and we worked, families lived and worked down in Pasadena. We all have a little different perspective of what it was like. And I know my perspective at times has a tendency to corrode a little bit. As I look back and I remember things that happened in circumstances, it has a tendency to corrode a little bit. And I asked Otto, I said, well, you know, you worked in Pasadena. What was it like? And Otto says, well, he says it was an honor. And I thought, well, there goes the profitable discussion over all the problems of the past, you know. He said, it was an honor. And made me stop. Pause and reflect, and I thought, well, you know, that's why I stayed too. I was an honor. You know, the fact that indeed, maybe because the last taste was somewhat bitter, that sometimes we imagine the whole meal was spoiled. But when you go back through that finish, and then I remember why I stayed, and you know why I changed my profession from what I had chosen, and as I said, I always wanted to be an elder, but it wasn't like I had any option to therefore be in the ministry or even be ordained, and so I planned my own career, and I trained, and I prepared to do other things. And I would have been perfectly happy at that time to have done so. But when I had a chance to work in Pasadena, even though it wasn't exactly doing what I wanted to do, it was doing something I thought was a contribution, and it was an honor to be offered the job to do that. It's easy to forget sometimes where we came from. It's easy to color our circumstances by the present issues that maybe now remain. Got another call last night, sitting at my desk. Ken Lilly called, a good friend of mine. When I was in Lubbock, I would take, and my cousin and his wife, Lynn and Gloria, usually come here for Pentecost and attend, and he lived in Arizona. So I'd take the teenagers there in the YOU, and we'd get together, and we'd take some of them over sometimes all the way to Arizona. That tells you a little bit about the panhandle of Texas. I had to go fishing in Arizona. I'd take them over, we'd camp, we'd fish, and once in a while I'd go over just by myself and camp and fish. And Ken Lilly was one of the members there in Phoenix, and he was a friend, came out, got to know him. And so he was coming up here last Pentecost, and I was going to let him do sermonette here because he speaks on the schedule down there. And he got sick and almost died. He was in the hospital. And there have been a couple times that's happened, and he's doing a little better now, but still has to be careful. Now he's telling me, I'm going to come see you next Pentecost. He says, I'll be right there. And I says, all right, you come, and I'll let you speak. And he says, well, can I have a split? And I said, no. Getting a little feisty there. I said, no, you can't bump me off the schedule, but I will let you give a sermon. He says, okay. He says, you know, I just read a poem, and he writes poetry, and he's a very, very good poet. And he told about a poem, and the poem is this hiker came to a stream, and he noticed in the stream there were rocks and stones, and he looked there closer, and they had been placed in the stream so that you could cross. He says he's reading this poem, and he got to thinking about that in terms of his Christian life. He said, you know, he says, it made me realize, he said, I am those stones for someone else. I go before, and I lay out for people to come behind me and make it possible for them to follow. He says, as I read that, realized that I am those stones. He says, you know, I might want to address that. I said, it'll be too late. I'm going to mention it tomorrow. You'll have to get something else. Brethren, we need to strive to make that path for others as easy as we possibly can, because we go forth, we go first, and we lay out those steps for them to follow. We need to strive to be supportive and positive and caring. We need to strive to be encouraging. God is indeed a comfort to us, and let us therefore also be a comfort to each other as well.